said there was a little bending. First he said there was none. Well, then he said there was a little bending.
No, I don't believe so. The kind of bending, I doubt if it would have been detectable in the spacecraft. And frankly, the data that we saw, the attitude errors and rates and things for the full 100% amplitude stroker, indicated maybe a small amount more bending, but most of the motion that was observed with a preliminary look at the data was rigid body data, as opposed to this thing, it's the whole vehicle going like this.
Is that expected?
Yes. I think what we were trying to do is get it to go like this instead of getting it to go like this, of course. But I'll say again that finding out whether we really did get the bending, the frequencies excited that we needed to get excited is going to have to wait for post-flight analysis. And all I can say is from all indications that we see now, it looks like we had a couple of real good tests, and it looks like they probably got the data they needed.
Well, let's go right here. Do you have a figure of the propellants used up by today's three burns?
I got the last weight, Neil, if you knew what some of the earlier ones were.
I can guess. Let's see. We were probably used about today. Why don't you ask another question? Somebody got a pencil and I'll figure you one.
Yeah, usually in the commentary at a number of points, the PAO will identify who is speaking from the spacecraft. This has kind of been absent today, and we got editors back home who go out of their minds, you know, and yell at you over the telephone if you don't attribute the quotes. Any way you can help us out.
That's all right. I get it.
You want us to identify each speaker?
Well, usually in the previous missions, the PAO came in enough times that you could tell who was speaking or be able to attribute enough quotes. This afternoon, it really hasn't been so. And,
okay,
you know,
well, I think where that can come in naturally, we'll do it, but we can't do it all the time.
Yeah, that isn't going to work worth a darn tomorrow, because tomorrow you're going to hear all three guys going simultaneously.
Yeah.
You haven't heard anything like you're going to hear tomorrow.
Same line. Jack, if you could do it in your summaries, it would help, where you can identify, if you hear little gems, if you could identify who said them. He doesn't hear me.
I'll identify the gems. go ahead, Arthur. Oh, you have a question. I'm sorry.
But I have a question. Okay. McDivitt's pretty hoarse, isn't he? Have we any new updates on how the guys feel that you could clue us in on?
No, I think actually...
Dave and Rusty sound fine. McDivitt sounds a little hoarse to us.
I don't know. I really didn't notice myself.
Let me answer the question on the propellant.
Are we finished? You finished with that?
Yeah.
About 27,500 pounds. That's the three burns today. That's rough, but that's close. Been a couple hundred pounds.
Arthur?
During the... manual control portion of SPS number 4, I guess it was, Scott commented on how it felt to fly the spacecraft, and it seemed to me that he was talking about he got some kind of give in flying it manually that wasn't present during the autopilot, but that was just sort of an impression on my part, and I'd like some professional interpretation of how the manual portion of that burn went.
I didn't get any impression like that from his comments during the burn. It was on SPS-3, by the way.
That's right.
And he took over 45 seconds from cutoff and flew it on in. And we're able to see on the ground, able to see the kind of rates he maintained and the amount of stick movement as he moved the stick around. And frankly, if you want to know the real truth, from all observations on the ground, he can fly it as well as the autopilot can.
Yeah,
that's my impression.
I think to answer one of your questions, this is the second time I think this has come up in here. I think you might have heard the conversation he had relative to the comparison of the SPS thrusting versus his RCS thrusting. And he was saying that the RCS, it sort of like felt like it was vibrating when it was under RCS thrust, but it was very solid under SPS thrust. And I think that's maybe you might have heard only part of the conversation.
And it doesn't surprise us. That doesn't surprise me either, because you got to remember that the plane of the RCS thrusters is clear back here, and the CG of that docked vehicle is way out in front of them. Okay, whereas in the SPS case, you know, we try very hard to point the thrust vector right through the CG. But the RCS is working against a pretty good moment arm there, so that doesn't surprise me.
Okay, we have the latest TV times from the control center, and they have not changed from the flight plan. 4627 to 4634 tomorrow, and on the second, the EVA pass, 75 hours even to 7515. Go ahead, Tom.
Jim, have you been able to figure out the comm problem where they had the ground, you know, radio stations or some Air Force base or Navy Air Force base butt again? Have you been able to come up with anything on that?
No, actually, the
Chinese radio stations.
We can only track that so far. We tend to believe they were probably some possible military communications over in Southeast Asia. And I think our recommendation, rather than trying to pursue this thing down, is to have them turn off their B receiver tonight. And that's basically what we did. We recommend they turn off their B receiver. We'll remain in simplex A air-to-ground communications, and for a backup, if we need to get them, we can use the crew alert command.
Is there any particular activation of systems tomorrow in the LEM that is more critical than been assuming? Other than the ignition of the engine, is there a certain switch they throw for power through most of the LEM systems? That would be...
Gee, that's really hard to say. I brought Tommy along just in case you had any questions as to the sequence or the purpose of a lot of the tests. I think the majority of the functions in the LEM are going to be quite critical tomorrow. You've got to get the ECS powered up just to provide the cooling for the men and the equipment. You've got to get the electrical system powered up to just keep the whole thing running. So I don't think there will be any surprises in there tomorrow, and I can't state what would be most critical. I think the entire operation is going to be critical from a standpoint of going on with the rest of the mission.
All
right. What's the situation on the tunnel right now? Is it pressurized or what?
It's pressurized.
And you still have the hatches closed?
Yes.
And the docking stuff in there?
Affirmative. We'll pull that out tomorrow.
I wonder if Tommy could tell us in some detail the physical activities that these guys are going to be going through, say, in the first 30 minutes, hour and a half of getting from the CM into the LM and getting it activated before they start running, before they start running tests.
Well, I don't know how much detail I could go into, but when they first start off, Dave Scott will climb up on the into the tunnel with his feet on the center couch and will remove the CM hatch. Then he'll remove the Drogon probe, pass it back down to the other guys. After he clears the tunnel, then he'll get out of the way, and Rusty will go into the LEM with on the CMP's umbilical, at which time he'll start powering up the LEM. After he has the LEM basic systems in the LEM powered up, such as the ECS, EPS, caution and warning systems, then the commander will join him. After we get the OPS checked out and a few other minor things checked out, Dave will start putting the drogue and the probe back into the tunnel.
Well, for instance, Rusty goes in, and then does Jim or does Dave pass in a good bit of equipment to him immediately, or what's Rusty going to do during the first very few minutes that he's in there?
Well, they'll pass in some books, some checklists, also some other gear. He'll start powering up the ECS equipment almost immediately when he gets in. The first thing he does is check all his switches and all of his circuit breakers and ensure that they're where they were when we lifted the bird off the pad. Then he'll power up the ECS system. They'll pass some checklists that were launched in the CSM that will be used in the LEM and across to the LEM. And once he gets the ECS working, the commander will come over and join him.
One other question. Well, let me ask if it's not too far off track. Will tomorrow be the first time you get a look at the rates of pressure buildup on the supercritical helium in the LEM? or have you been able to get some rates on that?
No, we haven't. We had the rates pre-launch. Tomorrow we'll have a good hack in the rates because we know what it was pre-launch. We'll see what it is when we get there, and we know how long we've been flying. So I think tomorrow that's one of the items that we're certainly going to be interested in, to find out how good a vessel did we have from a standpoint of maintaining our supercritical helium at the proper operating pressures. But after, I guess I might say, after we do make the burn tomorrow, the supercritical, really, the system will still be active, but we're going to essentially close it back off because we'll have enough ullage capability, enough ullage pressure in the descent tank so that, again, we can continue the mission without any further need of the supercritical. It's the same thing as we've got in the SPS helium right now. We have enough ullage pressure in the tanks just to continue the mission as is.
Any further questions?
Hands up. Do Schweikert and Scott both go in head first or feet first into the lem? Is there a standard procedure there?
I believe they go head first.
Head Tommy? First.
Scott doesn't go in head first.
No, that's a good point.
Scott doesn't actually get into the lem, by the way. He only removes the hardware out of the tunnel and moves out of the way. That's right. They go through head first.
Both directions.
Both directions.
Could you tell us what is the main purpose for your descent burn tomorrow?
Any more?
Down with some luck.
Just one quick one. You did mention that you had a final weight figure, and let's have it.
Yeah, as far as I know right now, it's 30,599 pounds for the CSM. Pardon?
Close.
That's what they're... You passed to retro.
There'll be a demonstration of the Westinghouse TV camera in the big auditorium immediately after this briefing, and then in approximately a half an hour, TRW will have a LEM descent engine briefing at the Joint Industry Press Center at the King's Inn.
Thursday TV is going to be during the strike.
This is Apollo Control at 30 hours, 15 minutes into the flight. Sometime back during the last pass over Hawaii, we recorded about a minute of air-to-ground between the Capcom here in Houston, which is Stu Roosa, and the commander, Jim McDivitt. We're prepared to play that back to you at this time.
Apollo 9, Houston to Hawaii. Roger, if you'll give me a dosimeter reading, I'll be quiet for the rest of the night.
Roger, the dosimeter for day 6102. My dosimeter is packed down at the bottom of my suit. If you want it, I'll pack it. If you don't need it, I'll delay it until tomorrow and give it to you.
That's negative. We don't want you to unpack it. And the first one was for Dave, is that right?
6102 is Dave.
Okay, I got that.
You only got Rusty's.
And I did not get Rusty's. Could you give me that one?
Oh, okay, just a minute. That's 8002.
Roger, 8002. And... with that, we'll close out. What we'd like to have you do in the morning would be to give us an evaluation of your sleep in hours, if you could, for tonight and the first night. We don't want to bother you with that now. And unless you have something else, why, Smokey bids you a fond night's sleep.
Okay, thanks very much. Will you tell my family I said hello?
Raj, we'll do that. Apollo 9, this is Houston. You don't even have to answer me, but if you don't get that filter change as shown on the 30 hours, you're going to have a master alarm before your rest period ends.
Roger, Houston, understand
that
we don't get the LIOH canister change before 30 hours, we'll have a master alarm before the end of our rest period.
That's affirmative. It's shown in the flight plan, and I just wanted to remind you before we got too far into the rest period.
That's all right. You know what I told my little reminds.
Roger.
Houston, this is Roger. Houston, this is Roger. Houston, this is Roger. How are things in Houston there, Smokey?
Say again?
How are things in Houston? Now that we're not working, I want to talk to you.
Negative. We refuse to talk to you. It's the rest period. The only thing we want is answered one question. Did you happen to move the B3 thruster switch? B1 thruster switch.
Roger, I did.
Okay, very good. That solves that problem, and we've reminded you of the canister, and that'll keep you from getting a master alarm, and we're not going to answer you anymore.
Hey, smart guy?
No,
hey,
sir.
Which one of those good teams is on right now? Gold or white or orange?
It's the G-squared team, the good gold.
Big gold.
At 30 hours, 19 minutes into the flight of Apollo 9, the spacecraft now is heading over the tip of South America. Next station to acquire will be Ascension. The crew pretty much is rested, or bedded down, rather. They're not rested yet, but they're pretty much bedded down, doing a few housekeeping duties. We'll continue to monitor here in Mission Control. At 30 hours, 20 minutes, this is Apollo Control.